Good evening. Please welcome Shackley's Chairman of Medical Affairs, Health Sciences and Education, Dr. Jamie McManus.
Hello, Shackley family, and welcome to our June conference call. It's great to be with you here at the start of summer. This tends to be a little bit of a crazy month with graduations and weddings and all sorts of special events that seem to be occurring in June. Kids getting out of school, vacations being contemplated, et cetera. It's also the month of Father's Day, and it's the month that we traditionally try to focus our attention, at least for this one month out of the year, on the men in our lives. Now, really, we really should spend a little more time than that, right? So, anyway, tonight we are going to talk about 50% of the population. Last month, Pam and I talked about women's health issues and gave you some specific kind of information and overview about how to incorporate our supplements to deal with some of the issues, especially the age and stage-related issues for women. Tonight, we're going to take a little bit different approach, and your Vice President of Health Sciences, Les Wong, is here with me. Hello, Les.
Hello, everybody.
And we are going to give you a little overview of what we see as the major issues for men, and then give you a little bit of a potpourri, a little bit of a collage of very recent kind of hot-off-the-press studies that relate specifically to men's health. So we hope that you can utilize these as a way to talk about men's health in general and introduce Shackley, as well as some of the things we'll talk tonight will be related to specific Shackley supplement solutions. But we're going to talk, this is going to be a little bit more kind of educational and informational, which is always great for your own level of knowledge and understanding, as well as opening the conversation with others. So just a quick review. Obviously, the major health trends today are really not specifically focusing on men. The increases in particular in the percentage of people that are overweight to obese, as well as the increases in diabetes, are somewhat evenly divided between men and women. Men are more likely to become morbidly obese than women. The trends in obesity, not just in overweight, but when you get into a BMI of higher than 30, we see a little increase in the ratios of men to women. Don't have a real understanding for that, but that's certainly the case. With diabetes, it's a little bit the opposite, which is interesting, in that possibly there may be genetic factors or hormonal factors that result in women actually having a little higher prevalence of diabetes than men. We are concerned with the healthcare crisis, with the cost of healthcare insurance, with the increasing percentage of people that are living longer, that is doing nothing but increase the cost of our healthcare, as to what the future holds. Some of the healthcare trends definitely show that medical costs are continuing to increase as much as 10% just in the last year. Unfortunately, employers are passing on most of those increased costs to employees. Health insurance premiums have increased actually four times faster than wages since 2004. And unfortunately, we don't feel that healthcare reform is going to change that in any measurable way, in any sort of positive way. When you look at how the healthcare dollar is spent, it really is spent largely on treatment and not on prevention. And for all of the talk about prevention in the whole Obama healthcare plan, less than 1% of it is actually earmarked for prevention services, true prevention. So we in Shackley are all about prevention. We truly believe that what we promote as far as a healthy lifestyle and everything that goes into that healthy lifestyle, which includes the incorporation of our supplementation and our weight management products, we are truly able to help people engage in true prevention. They are not going to learn how to do that from their doctors for the most part. They are going to learn that from you. So specifically the conditions that are really draining our healthcare dollars, that are driving up the cost of healthcare overall, are preventable conditions. For men, Clearly, the number one cause of death remains heart disease by a significant margin, and we know that this is preventable. Even the American Heart Association, which is a very conservative organization, states that 80% of heart disease is preventable with diet and lifestyle changes. And so, you know, again, 80%. So if a million people die of heart disease every year in America, and approximately half of those are men, approximately 500,000, 80% of those deaths, so approximately, you know, 450,000 of those people who died last year could possibly not have died if they had had the message of eating a healthier diet, controlling their weight, exercising, stop smoking, controlling their cholesterol, all the things that come along with a healthier diet and a healthier lifestyle. So we certainly can offer those sorts of solutions. Cancer. Lung cancer and prostate cancer are the two, followed by colon cancer, are the three leading types of cancer deaths that occur for men. Prostate cancer is the one cancer that is obviously unique to men. Women don't have a prostate gland, so we have those three cancers. We do know that that people are living longer with after they've been diagnosed with cancer. We are developing with each passing year better treatments for cancer, but we are not really making any inroads in the prevalence of cancer diagnoses, in the likelihood of you or I developing cancer in our lifetime. Those statistics haven't changed measurably for any cancer diagnosis, with the exception of lung cancer, as a result of the significant decline in the percentage of people who have smoked in their lifetime, or smoke regularly, or continue to smoke. And so as a result of that, there's the only place. So again, by prevention strategies, not by treatment, but by a change in lifestyle, by cessation of use of tobacco, you've been able to decrease the type of cancer. We also know American Cancer Society feels that as many as 60% of the cancer, new cancer diagnoses could potentially be preventable by virtue of, again, diet and lifestyle. By lifestyle, of course, we incorporate weight management into that. This diet and lifestyle to us also includes, and it does in all with all of these assessments, achieving and maintaining a healthy weight. We know that obesity is strongly correlated with a number of different cancers, as well as a poorer prognosis even in certain cancers. Diabetes is the number four cause of death and contributes significantly to stroke deaths, as well as heart disease deaths, or heart disease in general. So diabetes is the looming, tremendous health issue that will have the single greatest impact upon our economy, as well as the status of health for Americans in the coming century. In the coming decades, as well as the coming century. And we're seeing, as we all know, we've talked about before, diabetes being diagnosed in smaller and smaller, younger and younger age ranges, where you now have children as young as 10, 11 years of age being diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. As many as 60 million Americans are at risk for developing diabetes. The American Academy of Pediatrics experts have stated that that if we don't change the current trends in obesity, that as many as one out of every three children born since the year 2000 will develop diabetes in their lifetime. So these are kind of staggering and rather depressing statistics if we didn't have some solutions to talk about tonight. Diabetes is, according to the American Diabetes Association, 90% preventable. I believe type 2 diabetes is 100% preventable as well as treatable. Diabetes is an area where we can actually talk about nutrition and weight management as being treatments for these diseases, as well as preventive strategies, of course. So again, you know, prevention is on our radar screen. We actually have a study from the, where was this published, Les? It was a Canadian study. Anyway, it's kind of an interesting thing, again, where basically wealthy men increase their likelihood of being overweight with every extra dollar they make. This is one where we don't want to stop you from making more money, of course. We're going to encourage you to build a good business because you have, of course, some ways to prevent that. But it is kind of interesting because, and this was a Canadian study, and what we see in many other countries around the world is that the higher your socioeconomic status, the less likely you are to be obese. Because you have more access to exercise, more access maybe to healthy foods, more access to weight management sorts of solutions. But here is a study that is, you know, being stated as being in stark contrast to what we see in much of the rest of the world. Not in the United States, though I think we also are beginning to see this as well in the United States. So this was presented at a recent conference, and this is data from the Canadian Community Health Survey. So the greatest increases in obesity levels were actually among the rich Canadians, sorry Canadians up there, as well as Korean men. One of their explanations is that Canadians love restaurants and people who regularly eat out tend to not have as much control over what they eat. We all know that's for sure. And that today's restaurant meals, there's been a number of studies also that have talked about how restaurant meals have increased significantly in portion size and therefore, of course, calorie content. And, of course, alcohol is another aspect of eating out for a lot of people and another way that you're consuming extra calories more so than you may think about. So again, just another interesting study, which I'm not sure what you do with that other than be depressed, I suppose, if you're a rich Canadian. But you can be one of the exceptions and start to turn that trend around. And so, you know, we feel that, you know, we obviously offer some tremendous solutions for overall health and for prevention of these top conditions that are clearly not only major causes of death. We talk about, you know, heart disease, cancer, stroke, and diabetes as the major causes of death, but they're also challenges of life. I mean, the cost of these diseases are actually relatively, the small percentage of that is related to the actual dying aspect of it, but more related to management. So the treatment and management of these chronic health conditions that lead ultimately to premature death is really what is burdening our society in a great way. Obviously, with our great nutrition solutions and weight management solutions in Shaklee, we have a way to help people understand that they can be in control of their health, that they can make healthy choices and really be in the in a better space as time goes by, that they are not, you know, that they are not going to develop those health conditions. We certainly know that your genetics plays a certain role, but I think we're understanding more and more that genetics play a smaller role, and your lifestyle choices, your diet, lifestyle, and supplementation choices actually play a much greater role in determining your health as you go through life, as well as your longevity. So I think from this we're, you know, kind of giving you a good setup for the kind of major health conditions and the fact that we obviously offer tremendous solutions with Vitalizer, Prescription for Healthier Life, Cinch as a weight management solution. So let's just go through some of the latest in studies that we've gathered for you that specifically relate to men's issues, and you can use these as talking points in helping introduce the great topic of Shaklee. So I'm going to now call upon Les to talk about the first couple of studies.
Well, let me talk first in general about something that Dr. McManus touched on, and that is the obesity epidemic. And there's this interesting study that shows the fastest growing obese populations happen to be in Canadian men and in Korean men as well. Some of the tools that we can use to address the growing epidemic of obesity includes a couple of things I'm going to talk about, the first one being dietary fiber. So dietary fiber is something that we have studied for a long time. There are many studies on dietary fibers. Rather than just single out a particular study, I want to talk a little bit in general about dietary fiber, how it can be helpful, how it can be a useful tool in fighting the obesity epidemic, and how exactly does fiber help in weight loss? Well, high fiber foods can help in a number of ways. Number one, they often take more work. They take more work to eat. They take longer to eat. You can swill down a 2-liter sugary soft drink in a matter of seconds, But if you're eating some whole grain, dense and chewy, fibrous plant food products, then that's going to take more time. It's going to take more effort. Nutrients going to be absorbed more slowly, which is a good thing, and the final impact is going to be good. You'll be less likely to overeat. The other thing about high-fiber diets is that they tend to bulk up. They tend to absorb water. They tend to expand, and this bulking effect, as it's caused, can actually cause, there's some theories about distension of the stomach and creating feelings of fullness, of absorbing the water such that the bolus in your digestive tract is expanding and gives a better feeling of fullness. The other thing is that high-fiber foods tend to be less energy-dense as some of the simple, sweetened, sugary, processed, fatty, salty snack-type foods. So you have a whole lot of things that are working on your behalf when you're trying to have a good diet and fight weight gain or obesity when you incorporate healthy dietary fibers into your diet. The other things that fibers are good for, of course you know that fibers are found dietary fibers are found in plant foods like fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and legumes are great sources. Beans, lentils, these things are great sources of dietary fibers. There's two types of dietary fibers that you consume in your food, and we strive and we recommend a balance of both types. That is insoluble fiber, which is a type of fiber that promotes the movement of material through your digestive tract. So this is the bulking material. People generally think of wheat bran products, things like this, the hulls of plant seeds and so forth, are things that add bulk to the diet. They promote regularity. They promote transit of materials through your digestive system, which also can be healthy from supporting a healthy elimination and a healthy sort of a detox, natural detox plan. So that's great. Soluble fibers are the types of fibers that you find in oats, peas, beans, apples, beans. They're gummy type things, that, and they typically dissolve in water and then gel up and swell up to form a matrix. And what this can do is help lower blood cholesterol for one thing. It can help modulate glucose levels to some degree. And this is soluble fiber that's found also in psyllium. And so a balance of these types of fibers is going to give you the best benefits that you can see from increasing consumption of dietary fiber. Again, those benefits include decreasing the transit time of materials through your systems, and for some, dietary fiber provides relief from irritable bowel syndrome. So that's important. In addition to speeding things through the colon or the bowel, a high-fiber diet helps to maintain colon health, and this can lower your risk of developing things like hemorrhoids, small outpouches in your colon, also called diverticular disease. And so that can be helpful in perhaps preventing diseases of the colon. I mentioned before lowering of lipid and cholesterol levels. Shackley has done research in the past on some of our dietary fiber products showing the benefits on blood lipid levels with regular consumption of dietary fiber. So we already know that's important. Helping to control blood sugar levels, and of course in this day and age with obesity and all the simple sugars and simple calories that we're consuming, diets high in dietary fiber have been associated with a reduced risk for developing type 2 diabetes, so that's important. Again, I mentioned the effects on weight loss already, and then of course potential effects on reducing the risk for colon polyps and prevention potentially of colon cancer. So dietary fiber is something that Shackley has always been a long-term fan of. We think that men in particular have a lot to gain from increasing dietary fiber intake. I can remember growing up as a kid and watching TV and watching Westerns on TV, and I know us guys were meat and potatoes guys there. We need to sort of reverse that and have colorful plates of food.
Colorful plates.
Lots of plants.
Exactly.
Whole grains. Meats are not necessarily bad, but we should, like my ancestors do, and that is to use meat almost as a condiment and tread in that area more lightly with whole, unprocessed type meats as condiments to your grains and plant food products. All right, the next thing I want to talk about real quickly is, again, a little bit more general. This one isn't really a study, but this one is actually an advocate, not an advocate, but a recommendation for multivitamin use. And we talk about this sometimes. We've been out on the road a little bit, and we've talked about this very recently because this is something that just came out of the Harvard School of Public Health Nutrition Source, which is one of their online communications pieces on health and nutrition. And this one was issued, this one I took out 5/20, so on May 20th of this year, so just a little less than a month ago, where the bottom line recommendation that they made was a daily multivitamin is a great nutrition insurance policy, and some extra vitamin D may add an extra health boost. And some of you may think, well, that's sort of a simplistic recommendation, and we think we know a lot more about this. But I would have to step in and say that this is a tremendous concession from a great educational institution to sort of make this recommendation, because it's not something that's been done in the last 100 or 150 years, and it goes against sort of the grain of what has been taught from a nutrition and lifestyle standpoint heretofore. So I think it's important to sort of give a head nod and be aware that this recommendation is out there. I'm just going to read a little bit from it. Trying to follow all the studies on vitamins and health can make your head swirl. But when it's all boiled down, the take-home message is actually pretty simple. A daily multivitamin and maybe an extra vitamin D supplement is a great way to make sure you're getting all the nutrients you need to be healthy. The folic acid in most multivitamins helps prevent neural tube defects in newborns. It may lower the risk of heart disease, colon cancer, and breast cancer. And vitamin D from a multivitamin or single supplement can lower the risk of colon and possibly many other cancers. So clearly they're recognizing all the recent research in the past few years, and even beyond, I suppose, supporting the benefits of having adequate or optimal vitamin D levels, particularly in your blood. And in fact, the Institute of Medicine right now has convened a committee which has been doing up to this point about almost a two-year study on looking at the vitamin D requirements. And by the end of summer, we're keeping our fingers crossed, by the end of summer, they are supposed to come out with new recommendations on what the recommended intake should be, what the recommended upper level intake should be, and so forth. So we're looking forward to getting that information. The Nutrition Source, also this from the Harvard School of Public Health, published in this same article, 5 quick tips for getting the right vitamins, and I'm going to paraphrase them for you. Number one, eat a healthy diet, and we completely agree that. A multivitamin provides insurance against deficiencies, but it's so very important to have healthy food patterns that are described on this website, et cetera, et cetera. Choose a diet rich in fruits, vegetables, whole grains, nuts, and healthy oils, and low in red meat and unhealthy fats, and we couldn't agree that more. Choose a daily multivitamin. A daily multivitamin is an inexpensive nutrition policy. Again, we've been saying that for quite some time. And it says try to take one every day. We think a daily regimen is the best one and the easiest one, the simplest one to follow, and you're more likely to be compliant and get the benefits that way. Think about vitamin D as point number 3 of 5. In addition to its bone health benefits, there's growing evidence that getting some extra vitamin D can help lower the risk of colon and breast cancer. Aim for getting 1,000 to 2,000 international units of vitamin D per day. Interesting. That's the amount that we recommend here as a good starting point for most people with normal risk levels. And this likely will require some extra vitamin D for more information, et cetera, et cetera. Say no to megas, which is point number four. In general, avoid mega dose vitamins and mega fortified foods. Vitamin D is an exception, as many people need more than the RDA. Number five, avoid super supplements. Don't be swayed by the health claims of the many health supplements advertised on TV and the internet. And here's a good mantra to follow. If they sound too good to be true, you can be sure they are. Save your money for healthy food and a good vacation. And with that, I'm going to turn it back to Dr. Jamie to talk to some of the studies that we found that were done recently that have interest of particular interest to men.
Yes, absolutely. And I hear you're going on a vacation, actually, speaking of that.
That is true.
So, yes, don't have any questions for Les next week. He's going to be gone on vacation. So he's taking that to heart, right?
That's right.
He read the site today, it's time to take a vacation. He's taking a vacation. No, we're just kidding. It's been planned for a while. His wife's going to wonder what the heck is going on there. Okay, so on to a couple of these studies. One is a real interesting study correlating omega-3 fatty acid intake to male infertility. So this is a University of Illinois study. It's a lab study. And they actually looked at mice that had basically the DHA, the gene responsible for the enzyme for making DHA, knocked out, so it didn't exist. And that male mice were infertile. And the reason they did this study is because it has been seen in multiple animal species that low levels of omega-3 and in particular low levels of DHA in the bloodstream seem to correlate with changes in sperm morphology or sperm counts or sperm activity. And so as a result of that, this is an interesting study, again, just published here in the last few months in the Journal of Lipid Research. And so essentially when DHA was then introduced into the diet, the fertility was completely restored. So this is the first time that the importance of DHA to male fertility has been shown this directly, and we clearly have a need to supplement with DHA because, just to remind everybody, our body has to make DHA. We don't standardly have DHA or make DHA in our bodies unless we have a dietary intake of alpha-linoleic acid, which are the vegetable oil sources of omega-3s. Alpha-linoleic acid or ALA is one type of omega-3, but those vegetable oils, including soybean oil, also tend to be sources of omega-6 fatty acids, and we know that there's a concern about kind of an imbalance out there related to inflammation and anti-inflammatory effects and pro-inflammatory effects related to the American diet and the Western diet, Canadian diet, being much more prominent and predominant in omega-6. So we really want to encourage people to, and this is another study, to build the need for supplementing with DHA. So, yes, you can give yourself these omega-6, omega-3 oils to make DHA, or you can obviously just consume DHA. Our Omega Guard is actually a great product that provides about 400 milligrams of DHA per 3 capsules of Omega Guard. The rest of it is EPA and then a few other miscellaneous omega-3 fatty acids. So Vitalize You as your foundation, and then Omega Guard, and another way to talk, another, especially for the young people, young men in your life, that, again, another good reason to supplement with omega-3s, especially if you're trying to add to your family. Okay, another study is actually kind of an interesting and rather worrisome study that just came out in the past few weeks. and talking about the significant increase in the rates of deaths in men from malignant melanoma. So as most of you know, malignant melanoma is the most deadly form of skin cancer. In fact, it's quite rare to die of skin cancer. Basal cell cancers and squamous cell cancers tend to be more, they don't spread distantly from the location, so usually by excising them, you can be cured, essentially, of your basal cell cancer or squamous cell cancer as the two most common types of skin cancers. Malignant melanoma is the least common of the of those three types of skin cancers, and yet it is not only significantly on the rise, but also the rate of dying, especially in men, has increased significantly. This data shows that the rate of death has doubled in the past 30 years. And so in the late 1970s, approximately 1.5 men from every 100,000 men were dying from melanoma, and now that has increased to 3.1, so essentially a doubling. Experts are obviously concerned about this because this is certainly a preventable condition. The other significant bit of information from this report is that the numbers are even more dismal in older men. So if you look at men that are over the age of 65, the death rates have risen even more shockingly, from 4.5 per 100,000 to 15.2 per 100,000, so essentially five times higher in men over the age of 65 than men of all ages as far as dying from malignant melanoma. So we're seeing an increase in incidence in both men and women, but it's been a much more slow rise in women as far as death rates. The increase in incidence for men and women has increased somewhat in parallel or in tandem, but the death rates for men are significantly different. And of course, the reason for that and the discussion of that in this report, as well as we can discuss here, is clearly that men may be less aware of a mole changing, or they may be more likely to dismiss it as being something not that important. Women maybe pay a little bit closer attention to their skin and to a mole or a change in a mole or a change in something that you have on your skin. And so, again, my advice, of course, that from the medical standpoint here would be to be sure that that all of you, males and females out there, are paying attention to your skin, are looking at moles and other things that may look like skin tags, or any lesion on your skin that is changing is something to be aware of. People can't always see that well in, say, the back of their legs or in their back in general, so that's something that husbands and wives can do for each other. If you're not married, find a friend that you feel comfortable with, or see your doctor. Certainly, the dermatologists are quite amenable to seeing people on a somewhat regular basis. If you have malignant melanoma in your family, that also significantly increases your likelihood of developing a malignant melanoma in you. There is definitely a genetic correlation with malignant melanoma, and so it's something that we're all potentially at risk for. The more sun exposure you have, the more unprotected sun exposure you have. The occurrence of sunburns, especially in your youth, and especially in the teenage years, is strongly correlated. There's a direct correlation between the number of sunburns in your childhood and the likelihood of developing melanoma. So again, these are all things to be aware of out there, because again, we're talking a lot about prevention. This is another condition that you can prevent, or at least prevent it from being a fatal condition by virtue of an early diagnosis, so being aware. Okay, and I'm going to send it back to Les for another couple of interesting studies.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about one of our favorite topics here at Shackley and Shackley Health Sciences, and that is exercise. And I know exercise applies equally to men and women, but let's focus on exercise and see if we can't get a few more of our male listeners out and engaging in regular exercise on a more frequent basis. And that's because there are so many benefits that you get from exercise, both physically, emotionally, in terms of helping to achieve and maintain a healthy weight, which, as Dr. McManus talked about earlier, we all know that achieving a healthy weight is probably the most important, the single most important thing you can do to reduce your risk for many of the chronic diseases, and that healthcare costs and healthcare concerns and quality of life would go way up if we all could make a significant impact on our overall weight as a population and as individuals. Well, I'm not going to go through the various studies that are looking at specific benefits of exercise. Suffice it to say that there are many of them out there. What I do want to talk a little bit about is the type of nutritional support, the type of ergogenic aids that you and sports nutrition strategies, just briefly, that you can incorporate into your exercise plan to help gain additional benefits out of the exercise that you do choose to do. And these benefits are real. They've been clinically studied. We've done some ourselves. One of the studies that we did recently, which I think was very interesting because of the population we chose. There's so many of these studies that have been done in elite athletes or world-class athletes, and we've done some of those studies as well with bikers, particularly with bicyclists over the years. But one study that we conducted last year on this was at the South Shore YMCA with Dr. Wayne Westcott, who we are engaged in yet another follow-up study with him. But they his group studied sedentary, middle-age, primarily women who were starting an exercise program and getting off the couch, so to speak, and beginning to do just very typically moderate exercise, both resistance training and also some aerobic conditioning. But again, this was a graded program that was administered to, again, previously sedentary individuals and just sort of getting them up and starting them on an exercise program. After the six-month program finished, it ends up that those who were on the exercise program only did see significant improvements in body lean mass gain and fat mass loss and weight loss. But interestingly enough, those who took a protein carbohydrate meal replacement product directly after each exercise session actually lost more weight. So they improved their weight loss, they actually lost more fat mass, and they actually gained more lean mass as well. So it's interesting how the nutritional support can actually improve the benefits that you're getting out of exercise, and you don't need to be a world-class athlete, an Olympic athlete, a gold medal-winning athlete to take advantage of that tool to improve your performance. The key nutritional interventions and the key nutritional supports that you need to be concerned with, first and foremost, make sure as the summer months are coming, make sure you're hydrated, make sure you're well hydrated, make sure you're pre-hydrated before exercise, that you're hydrating during exercise, particularly if it's lasting 1 hour or longer and you're outside in the heat and humidity, and make sure that you're making up for hydration post-exercise by consuming enough water, and with the heat and humidity, we're recommending, of course, sports nutrition and electrolyte, carbohydrate electrolyte drinks to replace the electrolytes that you're losing and sweating out, and also to provide the carbohydrate fuel and energy that your muscles need, particularly for longer bouts of exercise. Carbohydrates, as I mentioned, are important. Depending on the type of event that you're working with, carbohydrate food, carbohydrate beverages, and protein carbohydrate beverages can be important as quickly absorbable foods to fuel your activity. The beauty of some of the sports nutrition beverages and shakes that you can use pre-event is that because they're in liquid form and can be absorbed more quickly, you can take in these products closer to your exercise. One of the issues that many athletes have is they don't like to eat very close to their exercise because of fullness and they're just not comfortable eating. Well, some of the meal replacement products can be excellent in helping to get your last bits of fuel in before you actually begin to exercise. Strategic sports nutrition also includes taking in products at the right time, and the most important in terms of timing for a sports nutrition product is after exercise, because that fuels the recovery, that fuels the repair, the rebuilding and recovery that your body needs after it's gone through a workout. We know that we've done a couple studies here showing that a protein carbohydrate beverage actually enhances and improves the rate of recovery, and again improves the recovery from exercise. And again, you're doing the exercise, take advantage of the sports nutrition that can actually build on that and get you additional benefit, and we've got a lot of materials and available to help clarify just what kinds of which products are right, when they should be taken, and how quickly they should be taken. But the general rule is that after you have a good workout, the sooner you take in your recovery beverage, the better your body takes advantage of that window of opportunity, as I mentioned, to repair, rebuild, and recover both muscle, lean mass, and energy stores as well. Well, for those of you who are inspired to go and do these workout and exercise in the summer and who haven't been doing this on a regular basis, some of you may have a tendency or propensity to overdo it. And in that particular case, there are some things that you can do to or products that you can take, that ingredients that can help you get through those tougher times, or ingredients that you can use prior to exercise to help in this area. One of the ingredients that is very important in terms of supporting healthy cartilage and supporting healthy joint function and range of motion and flexibility is glucosamine. It's an ingredient that we've liked for years and followed for years because of some of the science that we see with it. We've done some of our own. There's a couple of studies that have just been out in the last, both of these are 2010 studies. Actually, both of these are in the last month, and they're interesting studies. And I just want to point out, again, the continuing research that's done in the area of glucosamine, and these studies are getting more esoteric, and the comparisons are very, very interesting. The first one of the studies was done at the University of Utah School of Medicine in Salt Lake City. This was actually a study of the efficacy of glucosamine, chondroitin, the combination, and also celecoxib, or a placebo, taken to treat osteoarthritis of the knee, and this is a two-year result. Knee osteoarthritis is a major cause of pain and functional limitation in older adults, yet long-term studies of medical treatments of osteoarthritis are truly limited. This study was done to evaluate the efficacy and safety of glucosamine and chondroitin alone or in combination on painful knee osteoarthritis over 2 years. This was a 24-month double-blind placebo-controlled study that was conducted at 9 sites in the U.S., and there were 62 patients who were enrolled in what was called the glucosamine chondroitin arthritis intervention trial. These folks had knee osteoarthritis. They satisfied the criteria for this particular study. I'm not going to get into the technical details of their qualification. This subset continued to receive their treatment, which was either glucosamine at 500 milligrams 3 times daily, which is 1,500 milligrams per day, what we think the recommended amount, chondroitin sulfate, 400 milligrams 3 times daily, or the combination of both, celecoxib, the pharmaceutical, 200 milligrams daily, or a placebo. And what the investigators were looking for was a 20% reduction in a measured osteoarthritis index of pain over 24 months, and there were secondary outcome measures as well. Well, in terms of the results, the odds of achieving a 20% reduction in pain were about identical for the celecoxib and the glucosamine, much lower for the glucosamine chondroitin combination, and even lower than that for the chondroitin ingredient alone. So that was an interesting trend in how those results played out. The authors conclude that over 2 years, no treatment truly achieved a clinically important difference in the WOMAC pain or function as compared with placebo. However, glucosamine and celecoxib showed beneficial trends. Adverse reactions were similar among treatment groups, and serious adverse events were rare for all treatments. These are very, I just want to point out, these are very complex studies to run. The actual measurements and determinations of pain, as you can imagine, are very subjective, very difficult to measure. But it's interesting to me to see that the end result was that the glucosamine and the celecoxib showed beneficial and about equal level of effectiveness in this particular study. Here's yet another study I'm going to talk about very quickly. This was a study done in Belgium. We don't see a lot of studies done in Belgium. This one was done just on glucosamine in the treatment of knee osteoarthritis. And what I liked about this study was they did measurements of cost effectiveness and they compared it with paracetamol. And this was a six-month study, a six-month time horizon, and cost and effectiveness data were derived through index data, et cetera, et cetera. I won't get into all the details there. Clinical effectiveness was converted into utility scores that allowed for computation of cost of cost versus quality of life, et cetera, and then calculated, and then the comparisons were made. The results suggest that in terms of the utility it scored baseline, there weren't statistically significant between the three groups, but there was a statistically significant difference from baseline to 6 months between the glucosamine sulfate and the others. So when comparing the glucosamine to the others. So the conclusion that they had was that the results of the present cost-effectiveness analysis suggest that glucosamine is a highly cost-effective therapy alternative compared with paracetamol and the placebo to treat patients diagnosed with primary knee, osteoarthritis. Now, we have looked at glucosamine as more preventive than a treatment as was used in this case, but we're happy to see some of the research come out, and it needs to be confirmed, and there needs to be more conclusive research done, but we're happy to see some continuing research on the safety and efficacy of glucose for, again, supporting joint health, range of motion, and flexibility. And now back to Dr. Jamie.
All right, thanks, Les. We're going to close up with one last study and then open it up for questions here for our usual Q&A segment. And this last one is on the use of alternative sorts of products in the treatment of symptomatic benign prostatic hyperplasia, or BPH, as it's known. Most men out there probably recognize those initials. And that just basically means the slow, gradual enlargement of the prostate gland over time. And with each passing year, men are a bit more likely to have urinary symptoms in particular that do definitely interfere with the quality of life, starting your stream, having a good constant stream, et cetera. And so as a result of that, there are some drugs that are available, not a lot of options, but there are a couple of alpha blockers and 5-alpha reductase inhibitors that are used for symptomatic BPH. You see them advertised on television. But the reality is that those definitely have their side effects, which is why a lot of men try them and then feel like they just don't have another option. We know that both pumpkin seed oil and saw palmetto oil have been used as alternative modalities. And so this is a study that was just published. It's a Korean study. Actually, it was just published looking at the use of pumpkin seed oil, saw palmetto oil, and the two together in a variety in men with symptomatic BPH, and looking at a number of different parameters. So it's nice to see, actually, the results, which do show a definite positive effect of both pumpkin seed oil and saw palmetto in an overall what we call an international prostate symptom score. So this is basically when you look at a questionnaire related to symptoms of a healthy prostate functioning versus not healthy prostate functioning, there was a significant change, especially in the individual ingredients of saw palmetto and pumpkin seed oil. The quality of life scores also showed positive changes with these modalities. There was no change in the size of the prostate, which is interesting, that these modalities are not decreasing the size, but somehow increasing the functionality. It's not completely understood. This group has their own discussion of the proposed mechanisms of action, but again, this is another very positive study that shows also no change in PSA scores, with the exception of the combination of the two ingredients together, saw palmetto and pumpkin seed oil. There was a slow gradual decline. This was a one-year study, so this is following men over 1 year. And there was a significant improvement in urinary flow, which is basically the main symptom that does interfere with quality of life. In conclusion, the results of this study basically show that, you know, that the symptoms of BPH, as which includes urinary flow, overall quality of life, function, can be positively affected by the use of these alternative modalities, that there's no change, certainly no negative change, because that's been something out there, that the use of saw palmetto may increase the PSA, leading to unnecessary biopsies in men who are using saw palmetto. This is a nice study that shows following a number of men over a year and not showing any significant increase. And in fact, in the group using the combination of saw palmetto and pumpkin seed oil, we saw a decline, a gradual continual decline over the 12 months. Also, there was no reported side effects of note and no dropouts from the study related to side effects. So again, a nice a study positioning the use of a safe botanical alternative to a pharmacologic approach that, you know, as all of you know out there, I don't need to tell you this, there, you yourselves out there, as well as many of the people that you talk to and know in your lives, would be happy to use safe and natural alternatives should they know about them. So this is another great study to talk about. I think with that, Les, we're, I think, probably about ready to open it up to questions. We have a few other studies, but I know that the question and answer session is always very appreciated by all of you. And so why don't we go ahead and tell our listeners how to get in queue for questions.
Thank you. We'll now begin the question and answer session. If you have a question, please press the number 1 on your touchtone phone. You will hear an acknowledgment that you have been placed in queue. If your question has been answered and you wish to be removed from the queue, please press the number 1 again. All questions will be queued in the order that they are received. Once again, if there are any questions, please press the 1 on your touchtone phone.
Okay, and while we're lining people up for questions, just a few announcements. One is next month's Health Science Call. We're going to do our Ask Dr. Jamie session, so that there will be very little didactic presentation, and instead we will just basically do a full Q&A. And then, of course, after conference in August, which I know we'll be seeing all of you there, we'll be looking forward to talking with you and spending time with you, and especially sharing with you everything that we've been doing in the last year since we last talked to some of you, although we've been out on the road a fair bit here in the spring, winter and spring months. The entire Health Sciences team has been crisscrossing the country, so I think we've talked to more of you this year probably than in other years, and we intend to be out on the road a little bit more in the coming year as well, something that we have been reminded of, the entire Health Science team here, that we really like being out with all of you in the field, and in particular, if we can be helpful in being at events and really allowing you to have a good reason to get new people to come and hear all about Shackley. We also want to remind everyone that the our nutrition product specialists in field support are available for you as well as your customers and members to ask questions. The calls are 10 to 3 Pacific Standard or Pacific Daylight Time, rather, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., and the number is 925-734-3638, 925-734-3638. Be sure you get your questions answered. It's nice to know that we have that service to offer.